Here are some of the things our negative emotions tell us. Fear tells us to move away from danger, to be careful. Sadness tells us that we've lost something, a relationship, an opportunity, or an idea. Anger is also a signal. Like fear, anger signals danger. However, rather than urging us to withdraw, anger is a sign that we need to move forward to confront the threat. Jesus' rage at the defilement of the temple is an example of how this feeling functions, John 2:13-17. Anger tells us that our boundaries have been violated. Much like a nation's radar defense system, angry feelings serve as an early warning system, telling us we're in danger of being injured or controlled. "So that's why I find myself hostile to pushy salesmen," Carl exclaimed. He couldn't understand why he had a hard time loving sales personnel who couldn't hear his no. They were attempting to get inside his financial boundaries, and Carl's anger was simply doing its job. Anger also provides us with a sense of power to solve a problem. It energizes us to protect ourselves, those we love, and our principles. In fact, a common Old Testament illustration of an angry person is someone with a hard-breathing nose. Imagine a bull in a ring, snorting and pawing, getting the steam up to attack, and you'll get the picture. However, as with all emotions, anger doesn't understand time. Anger doesn't dissipate automatically if the danger occurred 2 minutes ago or 20 years ago. It has to be worked through appropriately. Otherwise, anger simply lives inside the heart. This is why individuals with injured boundaries often are shocked by the rage they feel inside when they begin setting limits. This is generally not new anger, it's old anger. It's often years of no's that were never voiced, never respected, and never listened to. The protests against all the evil and violation of our souls sit inside us, waiting to tell their truths. The scriptures say that the earth quakes under a slave when he becomes king, Proverbs 30:22. The only difference between a slave and a king is that one has no choices and the other has all choices available to him. When you suddenly give those who have been imprisoned all their lives a great deal of power, the result is often an angry tyrant. Years of constant boundary violations generate great anger. It's very common for boundary-injured people to do some catching up with anger. They may have a season of looking at boundary violations of the past that they never realized existed. Nathan's family was known in his small town as the Ideal Family. Other kids envied him growing up, saying, "You're lucky. Your parents are so close to you. Mine couldn't care less about me." Feeling a great deal of gratitude for his close family, Nathan never noticed that his family carefully controlled differences and separateness. No one ever really disagreed or fought over values or feelings. "I always thought conflict meant a loss of love," he would say. It wasn't until Nathan's marriage began suffering that he began questioning his past. He naively married a woman who manipulated and controlled him. Several years into the marriage, he knew it was in serious trouble. But to Nathan's surprise, he was not only angry at himself for getting into this mess, but also at his parents for not equipping him with tools for handling life better. Because he genuinely loved the warm family into which he was raised, Nathan felt guilty and disloyal when he remembered occasions in which his attempts to separate from his parents and set his own limits were constantly and lovingly frustrated. Mom would cry about his argumentativeness. Dad would tell Nathan not to upset his mom, and Nathan's boundaries remained immature and non-functional. The more clearly he saw what this had cost him, the angrier he felt. "I made my own choices in life," he said, "but life would have been a lot better had they helped me learn to say no to people." Did Nathan remain angry at his parents forever? No, and neither do you have to. As hostile feelings surface, bring them to relationship. Confess them. The Bible tells us to tell the truth to each other about our lacks, so that we may be healed, James 5:16. Experience the grace of God through others who love you in your anger. This is a first step toward resolving past anger. A second step is to rebuild the injured parts of your soul. Take responsibility for healing the treasures that may have been violated. In Nathan's case, his sense of personal autonomy and safety had been deeply wounded. He had to practice for a long time to regain this in his primary relationships. But the more he healed, the less anger he felt. Finally, as you develop a sense of biblical boundaries, you develop more safely in the present. You develop more confidence. You are less enslaved to the fear of other people. In Nathan's case, he set better limits with his wife and improved his marriage. As you develop better boundaries, you have less need for anger. This is because in many cases, anger was the only boundary you had. Once you have your no intact, you no longer need the rage signal. You can see evil coming your way and prevent it from harming you by your boundaries. Don't fear the rage you discover when you first begin your boundary development. It is the protest of earlier parts of your soul. Those parts need to be unveiled, understood, and loved by God and people. And then you need to take responsibility for healing them and developing better boundaries. Boundaries decrease anger. This brings us to an important point about anger. The more biblical our boundaries are, the less anger we experience. Individuals with mature boundaries are the least angry people in the world. While those who are just beginning boundary work see their anger increase, this passes as boundaries grow and develop. Why is this? Remember the early warning system function of anger? We feel it when we are violated. If you can prevent boundary violation in the first place, you don't need the anger. You are more in control of your life and values. Tina resented her husband's coming home 45 minutes late to dinner every night. She had a hard time keeping the food hot. The kids were hungry and crabby, and their evening study schedule was thrown off. Things changed, however, when she began serving dinner on time with or without her husband. He came home to refrigerated leftovers that he had to reheat and eat alone. 3 or 4 sessions like this prompted Tina's husband to tear himself away from work earlier. Tina's boundary, eating with the kids on time, kept her from feeling violated and victimized. She got her needs met, the kids' needs met, and she didn't feel angry anymore. The old saying, "Don't get mad, just get even," isn't accurate. It's far better to say, "Don't get mad, set a limit." Myth number 6. When others set boundaries, it injures me. "Randy, I'm sorry, but I can't lend you the money," Pete said. "This is just a bad time for me." "My best friend," Randy thought to himself. "I come to him in need, and he refuses me. What a blow. I guess that shows me what kind of friendship we really have." Randy is preparing to embark on a life of boundarylessness with others. Why? Because being on the receiving end was hurtful to him. He even made an emotional vow never to put anyone else through his experience. Many of us are like Randy. Having someone say no to our request for support leaves a bad taste in our mouths. It feels hurtful, rejecting, or cold. It becomes difficult to conceive of setting limits as being helpful or good. Having to accept the boundaries of others is certainly not pleasant. None of us enjoys hearing the word no. Let's look at why accepting others' boundaries is such a problem. First, having inappropriate boundaries set on us can injure us, especially in childhood. A parent can hurt a child by not providing the correct amount of emotional connection at the appropriate time. Children's emotional and psychological needs are primarily the responsibility of the parents. The younger the child, the fewer places he or she can go to get those needs met. A self-centered, immature, or dependent parent can hurt a child by saying no at the wrong time. Robert's earliest memories were of being in his crib, alone in the room, for hours at a time. his parents would simply leave him there, thinking he was fine if he wasn't crying. Actually, he had moved past crying to infant depression. There, Noe created a deep sense of being unwanted, which followed him into adulthood. Second, we project our own injuries onto others. When we feel pain, one response is to disown the bad feeling and to throw it onto others. This is called projection. Quite often, people who have been hurt by inappropriate childhood boundaries will throw their fragility onto others. Sensing their own pain in others, they will avoid setting limits on others, as they imagine how devastating it would be to them. Robert had extreme difficulty setting nighttime limits with his 3-year-old daughter, Abby. Whenever she would cry about having to go to bed, he would panic inside, thinking, "I'm abandoning my daughter. She needs me, and I'm not there for her." Actually, he was a wonderful father, who read stories at night, prayed and sang songs with his little girl. But he read his own pain in her tears. Robert's injuries kept him from setting the correct limits on Abby's wish to keep him singing songs and playing until sunrise. Third, an inability to receive someone's boundary may mean there is an idolatrous relationship. Kathy felt wounded and isolated when her husband wouldn't want to talk at night. His silence resulted in severe feelings of alienation. She began wondering if she were being injured by her husband's boundaries. The real problem, however, lay in Kathy's dependence on her husband. Her emotional well-being rested on his being there for her at all times. He was to have provided everything that her own alcoholic parents hadn't. When he had a bad day and withdrew, her own day was a disaster. Though we certainly need each other, no one but God is indispensable. When a conflict with one significant person can bring us to despair, it is possible that we are putting that person on a throne that should only be occupied by God. We should never see one other person as the only source of good in the world. It hurts our spiritual and emotional freedom and our development. Ask yourself, if the person I can't hear and know from were to die tonight, to whom would I go? It's crucial to develop several deep, significant relationships. This allows those in our lives to feel free to say no to us without guilt because we have somewhere else to go. When we have a person we can't take no from, we have, in effect, handed over the control of our lives to them. All they have to do is threaten withdrawal, and we will comply. This occurs quite often in marriages, where one spouse is kept in emotional blackmail by the other's threat to leave. Not only is this no way to live, it doesn't work, either. The controller continues withdrawing whenever he or she is displeased, and the boundaryless person continues frantically scrambling to keep him or her happy. Dr. James Dobson's Love Must Be Tough is a classic work on this kind of boundary problem. Fourth, an inability to accept others' boundaries can indicate a problem in taking responsibility. Randy, who needed a loan from his best friend, is an example of this problem. He was making Pete responsible for his own financial woes. Some people become so accustomed to others rescuing them that they begin to believe that their well-being is someone else's problem. They feel let down and unloved when they aren't bailed out. They fail to accept responsibility for their own lives. Paul strongly confronted the Corinthians in a letter that has since been lost. He set limits on their rebelliousness. Thankfully, they responded well, as evidenced by Paul's words in 2 Corinthians 7:8-9. "Even if I caused you sorrow by my letter, I do not regret it. Though I did regret it, I see that my letter hurt you, but only for a little while. Yet now I am happy, not because you were made sorry, but because your sorrow led you to repentance." The Corinthians took, accepted, and responded well to Paul's boundaries, whatever they were. That's a sign of taking responsibility. It's helpful to remember Jesus' golden rule here. "In everything do to others what you would have them do to you." Matthew 7:12. Apply it to setting limits. Do you want others to respect your boundaries? then you must be willing to respect the boundaries of others. Myth number 7. Boundaries cause feelings of guilt. Edward shook his head.
"There's something not right about all this for me," he said. "My folks were always so caring and concerned about me. It's been such a great relationship. And then..."
He paused, groping for words.
"And then I met Judy, and we got married. And that was wonderful. We saw my folks every week, sometimes more. Then the kids came along. Everything was fine, until I got the job offer from across the country. It was the position of my dreams. Judy was excited about it, too. But as soon as I told my parents about the offer, things changed. I started hearing them talk about Dad's health. I hadn't realized it was that bad. About Mom's loneliness. About how we were the only bright spots in their lives. And about all the sacrifices they'd made for me. What do I do? They're right. They've given their lives to me. How can I leave them after all that?"
Edward isn't alone in his dilemma. One of the major obstacles to setting boundaries with others in our lives is our feelings of obligation. What do we owe not only our parents, but anyone who's been loving toward us? What's appropriate and biblical, and what isn't? Many individuals solve this dilemma by avoiding boundary setting with those to whom they feel an obligation. In this sense, they can avoid the guilty feelings that occur when they say no to someone who has been kind to them. They never leave home, never change schools or churches, and never switch jobs or friends, even when it would be an otherwise mature move. The idea is that because we have received something, we owe something. The problem is the non-existent debt. The love we receive, or money, or time, or anything which causes us to feel obligated, should be accepted as a gift. Gift implies no strings attached. All that's really needed is gratitude. The giver has no second thought that the present will provide a return. It was simply provided because someone loved someone and wanted to do something for him or her. Period. That is how God views his gift of salvation to us. It cost him his Son. It was motivated out of love for us, and our response is to receive it and to be grateful. Why is gratitude so important? Because God knows that our gratitude for what he has done for us will move us to love others. "As you were taught and overflowing with thankfulness." Colossians 2:7. What do we owe those who are kind to us, who have genuinely cared for us? We owe them thanks, and from our grateful heart we should go out and help others. We need to distinguish here between those who give to get and those who truly give selflessly. It's generally easy to tell the difference. If the giver is hurt or angered by a sincere thanks, the gift was probably a loan. If the gratitude is enough, you probably received a legitimate gift with no feelings of guilt attached. God does an instructive job of keeping the issue of gratitude and boundaries separate. In Revelation's letters to the 7 churches, he singles out 3 churches, Ephesus, Pergamum, and Thyatira. 1. He praises their accomplishments. Gratitude. 2. He then tells them that even so he has something against them. 2:4, 14, and 20. 3. He finally confronts their irresponsibilities. Boundaries. He doesn't allow the two issues to be confused. Neither should we. Myth number 8. Boundaries are permanent, and I'm afraid of burning my bridges.
"But what if I changed my mind?" Carla asked. "I'm scared that I'll set a boundary with my best friend, and then she'll leave and forget about me."
It's important to understand that your no is always subject to you. You own your boundaries. They don't own you. If you set limits with someone, and she responds maturely and lovingly, you can renegotiate the boundary. In addition, you can change the boundary if you are in a safer place. Changing and renegotiating boundaries has many biblical precedents. God chose not to destroy Nineveh, for example, when the city repented. Jonah 3:10. In addition, Paul rejected John Mark for a mission trip because the younger man had deserted Paul. Acts 15:37-39. Yet, years later, Paul requested John Mark's companionship. 2 Timothy 4:11. The timing was ripe to change his boundary. As you've probably noticed, some of these myths are genuine misconceptions you may have learned from distorted teachings. Yet others simply result from the fear of standing up and saying no to unbiblical responsibility. Prayerfully review which myths have entangled and ensnared you. Search the scripture mentioned in this chapter and ask God to give you a sense of confidence that He believes in good boundaries more than you do. Part 2. Boundary Conflicts. Chapter 7. Boundaries and Your Family. Susie had a problem that I had seen countless times before. This 30-year-old woman would return from a visit to her parents' home and suffer a deep depression. When she described her problem to me, I asked her if she noticed that every time she went home to visit, she came back extremely depressed.
"Why, that's ridiculous," she said. "I don't live there anymore. How could the trip affect me this way?"
When I asked her to describe the trip, Susie told of social gatherings with old friends and family times around the dinner table. These were fun, she said, especially when it was only family. "What do you mean, only family?" I asked.
"Well, other times my parents would invite some of my friends over, and I didn't like those dinners as well."
"Why was that?" Susie thought for a minute and then replied,
"I guess I start to feel guilty."
She began to recount the subtle remarks her parents would make, comparing her friends' lives to hers. They would talk of how wonderful it is for grandparents to have a hands-on role in raising the children. They would talk of the community activities her friends were doing, and how wonderful she would be at those activities if she only lived there. The list went on and on. Susie soon discovered that when she returned home, she felt as if she were bad for living where she lived. She had a nagging sense that she really should do what her parents wanted her to do. Susie had a common problem. She had made choices on the outside. She had moved away from the family she grew up in to pursue a career on her own. She had been paying her own bills. She had even gotten married and had a child. But on the inside, things were different. She did not have emotional permission to be a separate person, make free choices about her life, and not feel guilty when she did not do what her parents wanted. She could still yield to pressure. The real problem is on the inside. Remember, boundaries define someone's property. Susie and others like her do not really own themselves. People who own their lives do not feel guilty when they make choices about where they are going. They take other people into consideration, but when they make choices for the wishes of others, they are choosing out of love, not guilt, to advance a good, not to avoid being bad. Signs of a lack of boundaries. Let's look at some common signs of a lack of boundaries with the family we grew up in. Catching the virus. A common scenario is this. One spouse doesn't have good emotional boundaries with the family he grew up in, his family of origin. Then, when he has contact with them by phone or in person, he becomes depressed, argumentative, self-critical, perfectionistic, angry, combative, or withdrawn. It is as though he catches something from his family of origin and passes it on to his immediate family. His family of origin has the power to affect his new family in a trickle-down effect. One sure sign of boundary problems is when your relationship with one person has the power to affect your relationships with others. You are giving one person way too much power in your life. I remember one young woman who made steady gains in therapy until she talked to her mother, when she would withdraw for 3 weeks. She would say things like,
"I'm not changing at all. I'm not getting any better." Fusing with many of her mother's ideas about her, she wasn't able to stay separate. This fusion with her mother affected her other relationships. She virtually shut everyone out of her life after an interaction with her mother. Her mother owned her life. She was not her own.
Second fiddle.
You wouldn't believe how she is with him, Dan said. She totally focuses on his every wish. When he criticizes her, she tries harder, and she practically ignores me. I'm tired of being the second man in her life.
Dan wasn't talking about Jane's lover. He was talking about her father. Dan was tired of feeling like Jane cared more about her father's wishes than his. This is a common sign of a lack of boundaries with the family of origin. The spouse feels like he gets leftovers. He feels as if his mate's real allegiance is to her parents. This spouse hasn't completed the leaving before cleaving process. She has a boundary problem. God has designed the process whereby a man shall leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Genesis 2:24. The Hebrew word for leave comes from a root word that means to loosen or to relinquish or forsake. For marriage to work, the spouse needs to loosen her ties with her family of origin and forge new ones with the new family she is creating through marriage. This does not mean that husbands and wives shouldn't have a relationship with their extended families, but they do need to set clear boundaries with their families of origin. Many marriages fail because one partner fails to set clear boundaries with the family of origin, and the spouse and children get leftovers.
May I have my allowance, please?
Terry and Sherry were an attractive couple. They owned a big house and went on lavish vacations. Their children took piano lessons and ballet, and they had their own skis, rollerblades, ice skates, and windsurfers. Terry and Sherry had all the trappings of success, but there was one problem. This lifestyle was not supported by Terry's paycheck. Terry and Sherry received much financial help from his family. Terry's family had always wanted the best for him, and they had always helped him get it. They had contributed to the house, the vacations, and the children's hobbies. While this allowed Terry and Sherry to have things they could not otherwise have, it cost them dearly as well. The periodic bailouts from his parents cut into Terry's self-respect, and Sherry felt as if she couldn't spend any money without consulting her in-laws, since they contributed the funds. Terry illustrates a common boundary problem for young adults today, both married and single. He was not yet an adult financially. He could not set boundaries on his parents' desire for him and Sherry to have everything we have. He also found that he had so fused with their ideas of success that he had trouble saying no to these wishes in himself. He wasn't sure he wanted to forsake the gifts and handouts for a greater sense of independence. Terry's story is the upside of the financial boundary problem. There is also the I'm in trouble side. Many adult children perpetually get into financial messes because of irresponsibility, drug or alcohol use, out-of-control spending, or the modern I haven't found my niche syndrome. Their parents continue to finance this road of failure and irresponsibility, thinking that this time they'll do better. In reality, they are crippling their children for life, preventing them from achieving independence. An adult who does not stand on his own financially is still a child. To be an adult, you must live within your means and pay for your own failures.
Mom, where are my socks?
In the perpetual child syndrome, a person may be financially on his own, but allows his family of origin to perform certain life management functions. This adult child often hangs out at Mom and Dad's house, vacations with them, drops off laundry, and eats many meals there. He is Mom or Dad's closest confidant, sharing everything with them. At 30-something, he hasn't found his career niche, and he has no savings, no retirement plan, and no health insurance. On the surface, these things do not appear to be serious problems, but often Mom and Dad are symbolically keeping their adult child from emotionally leaving home. This often happens in friendly, loving families, where things are so nice, it's hard to leave. Psychologists often refer to this as the enmeshed family, one in which the children do not separate with clear boundaries. It does not look like a problem, because everyone gets along so well. The family is very happy with one another. However, the adult children's other adult relationships may be dysfunctional. They may choose black sheep, friends and lovers. They may be unable to commit to a member of the opposite sex or to a career. Often their finances are a problem. They have large and multiple credit card balances and usually are behind on their taxes. Although they may be earning their own way daily, they never think about the future. This is essentially an adolescent financial life. Adolescents make enough money to buy a surfboard, stereo, or dress, but do not think past the immediate present to the future. Did I make enough money for the pleasures of this weekend? Adolescents and adult children who have not separated from their parents are still under parental protection, and it's a parent's job to think about the future. Three's a crowd. Dysfunctional families are known for a certain type of boundary problem called triangulation. It goes something like this. Person A is angry at person B. Person A does not tell person B. Person A calls person C and gripes about person B. Person C enjoys person A's confidence and listens whenever A wants to play the triangle game. By this time, person B, feeling lonely, calls C and, in passing, mentions the conflict with A. Person C becomes the confidant of B as well as A. Persons A and B have not resolved their conflict, and C has two friends. Triangulation is the failure to resolve a conflict between two persons and the pulling in of a third to take sides. This is a boundary problem, because the third person has no business in the conflict, but is used for comfort and validation by the ones who are afraid to confront each other. This is how conflicts persist. People don't change, and enemies are made unnecessarily. What happens in the triangle is that people speak falsely, covering up their hatred with nice words and flattery. Person A is usually very cordial, nice, and even complimentary to B in person, but when A talks to C, the anger comes out. This is a clear lack of boundaries because person A is not owning his anger. The person with whom A is angry deserves to hear it, straight from him. How many times have you been hurt by a, "Do you know what John said about you?" And the last time you talked to John, things were fine. In addition, person C is being drawn into the conflict, and his knowledge of the conflict gets in the way of his relationship with person B. Gossip gets between people. It affects our opinions of the people being gossiped about without their having a chance to defend themselves. Many times what we hear from a third person is inaccurate. This is why the Bible commands us to listen to at least two or three witnesses, not just one. Triangulation is a common boundary problem with families of origin. Old patterns of conflict between a parent and a child, or between two parents, result in one family member calling another family member and talking about the third family member. These extremely destructive patterns keep people dysfunctional. The scripture is very serious about dealing with conflict directly with the one you are angry with. He who rebukes a man will in the end gain more favor than he who has a flattering tongue. Proverbs 28:23. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Rebuke your neighbor frankly so you will not share in his guilt. Leviticus 19:17. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, Go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Matthew 5:23-24. If your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault, just between the two of you. Matthew 18:15. These scriptures show that a simple way to avoid triangulation is to always talk to the person with whom you have a conflict first. Work it out with her, and only if she denies the problem, talk to someone else to get insight about how to resolve it, not to gossip and to bleed off anger. Then you both go to talk to her together to try to solve the problem. Never say to a third party something about someone that you do not plan to say to the person himself. Who's the child here, anyhow? Children should not have to save up for their parents, but parents for their children. 2 Corinthians 12:14. Some people were born to take care of their parents. They did not sign up for this duty. They inherited it. Today we call these people codependent. Early in life, they learned they were responsible for their parents, who were stuck in childish patterns of irresponsibility. When they became adults, they had a difficult time setting boundaries between themselves and their irresponsible parents. Every time they tried to have separate lives, they felt selfish. Indeed, the Bible teaches that adult children should take care of their elderly parents. Give proper recognition to those widows who are really in need. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, these should learn, first of all, to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family, and so repaying their parents and grandparents, for this is pleasing to God. 1 Timothy 5:3-4. It is good to feel grateful to our parents and to repay them for what they have done for us. But two problems generally crop up. First, your parents may not be really in need. They may be irresponsible, demanding, or acting like martyrs. They may need to take responsibility for their own knapsacks. Second, when they are really in need, you may not have clear boundaries to determine what you can give and what you can't give. You may not be able to limit your giving, and your parents' inability to adjust to old age, for example, will dominate your family. Such domination can ruin marriages and hurt children. A family needs to decide what they want to give and what they do not want to give, so they will continue to love and appreciate the parent and not grow resentful. Good boundaries prevent resentment. It is good to give. Make sure, however, that it is the proper amount for your situation and resources.
But I'm your brother.
Another frequent dynamic is the grown sibling relationship. An irresponsible adult child depends on a responsible adult sibling to avoid growing up and leaving the family. We are not talking about a true needy sibling who has a mental or physical impairment. The irresponsible child continues to play old family games well into adulthood. The tough issue here is the guilt and pressure you feel because it is your brother or sister. I have seen people do totally crazy and unhelpful things for a brother or sister that they would never do for their closest friend. Our families can tear down our best-built fences because they are family. But why do we do that? Why in the world do we choose to continue these sorts of patterns? What is wrong? One reason is that we did not learn the laws of boundaries in our family of origin, and our adult boundary problems are actually old boundary problems that have been there since childhood. Another reason is that we may not have gone through the biblical transition into adulthood and the spiritual adoption into the family of God. Let's look at both. Continuation of old boundary problems. Remember the story about the alien? He had grown up on another planet and was unfamiliar with the laws of Earth, such as gravity and money as a medium of exchange. The patterns you learn at home growing up are continued into adulthood with the same players. lack of consequences for irresponsible behavior, lack of confrontation, lack of limits, taking responsibility for others instead of yourself, giving out of compulsion and resentment, envy, passivity, and secrecy. These patterns are not new. They have just never been confronted and repented of. These patterns run deep. Your family members are the ones you learn to organize your life around, so they are able to send you back to old patterns by their very presence. You begin to act automatically out of memory instead of growth. To change, you must identify these sins of the family and turn from them. You must confess them as sins, repent of them, and change the way you handle them. The first step in establishing boundaries is becoming aware of old family patterns that you are still continuing in the present. Look at the struggles you are having with boundaries in your family of origin. Identify which laws are being broken, and then pinpoint the resulting negative fruit in your life. Adoption. This is not a book about spiritual development, but boundaries are an essential aspect of growing up. One step in growing up is coming out from under parental authority and putting yourself under God's authority. The Bible says that children are under the authority of their parents until they become adults, Galatians 4:1-7. In a real sense, their parents are responsible for them. But when adulthood and the age of accountability comes, that person comes out from under guardians and managers and becomes responsible for him or herself. Christians move into another parental relationship with God as Father. God does not leave us as orphans, but takes us into His family. Numerous New Testament passages teach that we need to forsake our allegiance to our original family and become adopted by God. Matthew 23:9. God commands us to look to Him as our Father and to have no parental intermediaries. Adults who are still holding an allegiance to earthly parents have not realized their new adoptive status. Many times we are not obeying the Word of God because we have not spiritually left home. We feel we still need to please our parents and their traditional ways of doing things rather than obey our new Father. Matthew 15:1-6. When we become part of God's family, obeying His ways will sometimes cause conflict in our families and sometimes separate us. Matthew 10:35-37. Jesus says that our spiritual ties are the closest and most important. Matthew 12:46-50. Our true family is the family of God. In this family, which is to be our strongest tie, things are done a certain way. We are to tell the truth, set limits, take and require responsibility, confront each other, forgive each other, and so on. Strong standards and values make this family run, and God will not allow it any other way in His family. This in no way means that we are to cut other ties. We are to have friends outside of God's family and strong ties with our family of origin. However, we need to ask two questions. Do these ties keep us from doing the right thing in any situation? And have we really become an adult in relation to our family of origin? If our ties are truly loving, we will be separate and free and give out of love and a purposeful heart. We will stay away from resentment, we will love with limits, and we will not enable evil behavior. If we are not under guardians and managers, as adults, we can make truly adult decisions, having control over our own will, 1 Corinthians 7:37, subject to our true Father. Resolution of boundary problems with family. Establishing boundaries with families of origin is a tough task, but one with great reward. It is a process with certain distinguishable steps. Identify the symptom. Look at your own life situation and see where boundary problems exist with your parents and siblings. The basic question is this: Where have you lost control of your property? Identify those areas and see their connection with the family you grew up in, and you are on your way. Identify the conflict. Discover what dynamic is being played out. For example, what law of boundaries are you violating? Do you triangulate? Do you take responsibility for a sibling or parent instead of being responsible to them? Do you fail to enforce consequences and end up paying for their behavior? Are you passive and reactive toward them and the conflict? You cannot stop acting out a dynamic until you understand what you are doing. Take the log out of your own eye. Then you will be able to see clearly to deal with your family members. See yourself as the problem, and find your boundary violations. Identify the need that drives the conflict. You do not act in inappropriate ways for no reason. You are often trying to meet some underlying need that your family of origin did not meet. Maybe we are still entangled because of a need to be loved, or approved of, or accepted. You must face this deficit and accept that it can only be met in your new family of God, those who are now your true mother, father, brothers, and sisters, those who do God's will and can love you the way He designed. Take in and receive the good. It is not enough to understand your need. You must get it met. God is willing to meet your needs through His people, but you must humble yourself. Reach out to a good support system and take in the good. Do not continue to hide your talent in the ground and expect to get better. Learn to respond to and receive love, even if you're clumsy at first. Practice boundary skills. Your boundary skills are fragile and new. You can't take them immediately into a difficult situation. Practice them in situations where they will be honored and respected. Begin saying no to people in your supportive group who will love and respect your boundaries. When you are recovering from a physical injury, you do not pick up the heaviest weight first. You build up to the heavy stuff. Look at it as you would physical therapy. Say no to the bad. In addition to practicing new skills in safe situations, avoid hurtful situations. When you are in the beginning stages of recovery, you need to avoid people who have abused and controlled you in the past. When you think you are ready to reestablish a relationship with someone who has been abusive and controlling in the past, bring a friend or supporter along. Be aware of your pull toward hurtful situations and relationships. The injury you are recovering from is serious, and you can't reestablish a relationship until you have the proper tools. Be careful to not get sucked into a controlling situation again, because your wish for reconciliation is so strong. Forgive the aggressor. Nothing clarifies boundaries more than forgiveness. To forgive someone means to let him off the hook, or to cancel a debt he owes you. When you refuse to forgive someone, you still want something from that person, and even if it is revenge that you want, it keeps you tied to him forever. Refusing to forgive a family member is one of the main reasons people are stuck for years, unable to separate from their dysfunctional families. They still want something from them. It is much better to receive grace from God, who has something to give, and to forgive those who have no money to pay their debt with. This ends your suffering, because it ends the wish for repayment that is never forthcoming, and that makes your heart sick because your hope is deferred. Proverbs 13:12. If you do not forgive, you are demanding something your offender does not choose to give, even if it is only confession of what he did. This ties him to you and ruins boundaries. Let the dysfunctional family you came from go. Cut it loose, and you will be free. Respond. Don't react. When you react to something that someone says or does, you may have a problem with boundaries. If someone is able to cause havoc by doing or saying something, she is in control of you at that point, and your boundaries are lost. When you respond, you remain in control, with options and choices. If you feel yourself reacting, step away and regain control of yourself so family members can't force you to do or say something you do not want to do or say, and something that violates your separateness. When you have kept your boundaries, choose the best option. The difference between responding and reacting is choice. When you are reacting, they are in control. When you respond, you are. Learn to love in freedom and responsibility, not in guilt. The best boundaries are loving ones. The person who has to remain forever in a protective mode is losing out on love and freedom. Boundaries in no way mean to stop loving. They mean the opposite. You are gaining freedom to love. It is good to sacrifice and deny yourself for the sake of others, but you need boundaries to make that choice. Practice purposeful giving to increase your freedom. Sometimes people who are building boundaries feel that to do someone a favor is codependent. Nothing is farther from the truth. Doing good for someone when you freely choose to do it is boundary enhancing. Codependents are not doing good. They are allowing evil because they are afraid. Chapter 8. Boundaries and Your Friends. Marcia switched on the television, not even noticing which show was on. She was thinking about her phone call with her best friend, Tammy. She had asked Tammy to go to a movie with her. Tammy had had other plans for the evening. Once again, Marcia had taken the initiative. Once again, she was disappointed. Tammy never called her. Was this what friendship was supposed to be about? Friendship. The word conjures up images of intimacy, fondness, and a mutual drawing together of two people. Friends are symbols of how meaningful our lives have been. The saddest people on earth are those who end their days with no relationships in which they are truly known and truly loved. Friendship can be a broad category. Most of the relationships mentioned in this book have friendship components. But for our purpose, let's define friendship as a non-romantic relationship that is attachment-based rather than function-based. In other words, let's exclude relationships based on a common task, like work or ministry. Let's look at friendship as comprising people we want to be around just for their own sake. Boundary conflicts with friends come in all sizes and shapes. To understand the various issues, let's look at a few conflicts and how they can be resolved with boundaries. Conflict number one, compliant. In some ways, it was a great friendship. In other ways, it was awful. Sean and Tim enjoyed the same sports, activities, and recreation. They went to the same church and liked the same restaurants. But they were just too nice to each other. They both had difficulty saying no to each other. Their realization of the problem came up one weekend when a whitewater rafting trip and a 60s concert were scheduled on the same day. Sean and Tim enjoyed both activities, but they couldn't do both. Sean called Tim, suggesting they go rafting. "Absolutely," answered his friend. However, unbeknownst to each other, neither Sean nor Tim really wanted to go rafting. In their heart of hearts, both men had been looking forward to going to the concert. Halfway down the river, Sean and Tim got honest with each other. Tired and wet, Tim blurted out, "It was your big idea to come on this trip."
"Tim?" Sean said with surprise. "I thought you wanted to go rafting."
"Oh, no. Since you called me, I forget that's what you wanted." "Old buddy," he continued ruefully, "maybe it's time we stopped treating each other like China dolls."
The result of two compliants interacting is that neither does what he really wants. Each is so afraid of telling the other the truth that neither ever does. Let's apply a boundary checklist to this conflict. This checklist of questions will not only help you locate where you are in setting boundaries, but also show you how to get where you want to go. 1. What are the symptoms? One symptom of a compliant,
compliant conflict is dissatisfaction, a sense that you allowed something you shouldn't have. 2. What are the roots? Compliance come from backgrounds where they had to avoid saying no to keep others happy. Since their roots are similar, it's often hard for two compliant people to help each other. 3. What is the boundary conflict? Compliant people politely deny their own boundaries to keep the peace. 4. Who needs to take ownership? Each compliant needs to take responsibility for his or her attempts to appease or please the other. Sean and Tim both need to admit that they each control the other by being nice. 5. What do they need? Compliant people need to have supportive relationships to plug into, be they support groups, home Bible studies, or counselors. Their fear of hurting the other person makes it difficult for them to set boundaries on their own. 6. How do they begin? Both compliants practice setting limits on trivial things. They may begin with being honest about things like tastes in restaurants, church liturgies, music, and the like. 7. How do they set boundaries with each other? Sean and Tim talk with each other face to face, finally telling the truth and revealing limits they'd like to start setting. They commit themselves to better boundaries with each other. 8. What happens next? Sean and Tim may have to admit that their interests are not as similar as they had thought. They may need to separate more from each other. Having different friends for different activities is no blot on the relationship. It might help their friendship in the long run. Conflict number 2. Compliant, aggressive controller. The compliant, aggressive controller conflict, the most identifiable of friendship conflicts, has classic symptoms. The compliant feels intimidated and inferior in the relationship. The aggressive controller feels irritated at being nagged by the compliant.
"Well, all right, if you insist," is a catchphrase of the compliant.
Usually, the aggressive controller is insisting on using some of the compliant's time, talents, or treasures. The aggressive controller has no problem demanding what she wants. Sometimes she just takes what she wants without asking. "I needed it," is enough reason for the aggressive controller to help herself to whatever the compliant has, be it car keys, a cup of sugar, or 3 hours of time. Since the compliant is usually unhappy in this relationship, he is the one who needs to take action. Let's put this relationship through the boundary checklist. 1. What are the symptoms? The compliant feels controlled and resentful. The aggressive controller feels good, except she doesn't like to be nagged. 2. What are the roots? The compliant probably grew up in a family who taught him to avoid conflict rather than embrace it. The aggressive controller never received training in delaying gratification and in taking responsibility for herself. 3. What is the boundary conflict? Two specific boundary conflicts are the inability of the compliant to set clear limits with his friend and the inability of the aggressive controller to respect the compliant's limits. 4. Who needs to take ownership? The compliant needs to see that he isn't the victim of the aggressive controller. He is volunteering his power to his friend on a silver platter. Giving up his power is his way of controlling his friend. The compliant controls the aggressive controller by pleasing her, hoping it will appease her and cause her to change her behavior. The aggressive controller needs to own that she has difficulty listening to no and accepting the limits of others. She needs to take responsibility for her need to control her friend. 5. What is needed? The unhappier one in the friendship, the compliant, needs to plug into a supportive group of people to help him with this boundary conflict. 6. How do they begin? In preparation for confronting his friend, the compliant needs to practice setting limits in his support group. The aggressive controller could really benefit from honest feedback from loving friends on how she runs over people and how she can learn to respect the limits of others.
7. How do they set boundaries?